They are so sensitive, they seem to die en masse at the first sign of trouble. As such, they have become canaries in the mine of our environment. And given their great die-offs of the past few years, you must believe that our environment must be in deep trouble. But this leads us to ask, why are honeybees thriving in Los Angeles?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 591st edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Buenos Aires who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Nikki James, producers Carol Stafford, Parmley Taff, and Kelsey Olson. Folks, with colony collapse disorder being the order of the day, it has been hard times for the honeybees of our world. And yet they seem to be surviving and prospering in the most unnatural of locations, like the city of Los Angeles. And so today we pause to ask, what do honeybees have to offer the big city? Here to help us find an answer, we have Kirk Anderson of Kirk's Urban Bees in Los Angeles, California. Kirk, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thanks for having me.
Pleasure to have you aboard. Kirksurbanbees.com. What are you?
Well, I'm just a beekeeper, an urban beekeeper. I'm actually a house painter, but on the side, I like bees, so I play around with bees.
Well, we always ask the question, who pays the way? So if you're a house painter, we have a pretty good notion of who's paying your way, right?
Yeah, that's right. I'm paying my own way.
You're not getting a grant from some large government institution or some large corporation. This is Kirk Anderson of Kirk's Urban Bees, and he pays his own way, which is where we want to be, too. Let's start at the beginning, Kirk. You were born and raised in Salt Lake City. Is that where you first discovered bees?
Yep, that's where I first started. I ordered my first package of bees from Montgomery Ward through the mail.
Wow. And why did you do that? What led you to order bees, of all things?
Well, I was just sitting down having some tea with my friend Stu Gelb, who had just arrived in Salt Lake City from the Wheeler Ranch commune in California. He said, boy, the price of honey is way up. I said, well, we should get some bees. So I went and ordered some bees.
And Montgomery Ward, now there's an old name. That would be a name that would please my father to no end. Monkey Wards, he called him.
Yeah, Montgomery Wards and Sears both used to have a ranch catalog where you could order chickens, ducks, bees. Hmm. But then Montgomery Ward went out of business, and then Sears stopped their ranch catalog, and so
no more bees in the Monkey Ward catalog, right?
That's right.
So you ordered bees. What happened?
Well, they came in the mail, and the post.
How do bees come in the mail?
Well, they come in a screened cage with a can of food and a queen bee. And the mailman knocked on my door and said, "You have to come out and get them. They're in a box in the mail truck. I don't want to touch them."
There they were.
So I had bought a beehive in the meantime and put it together, and I took them down to my mother's house and put them in the box, and that's how I started.
And said, here, Mom, have a beehive?
Yeah, my mother's house. It was.
How did she react to that?
Oh, she didn't mind. She thought it was great. My dad thought I was crazy, but she thought it was great.
So you became a bee. How old were you then?
I was about 25 then.
Okay, so young man in the bee business. What were you aiming for then?
You know, I was just fascinated by bugs.
Mm-hmm.
I've always liked insects, and I always liked bugs, and I always liked gardens, and I liked living things, and the bees have a lot to do with it. You know, you spend a day with some bees, and once you get stung, you know, they've got you.
So to speak, and actually do, don't they?
Yeah, so
and
I guess,
you know, Kirk, they've got me, because I guess about once a year, I like to check in with the bees and the people of the bees, because I find the people of the bees, like you, almost as fascinating as the bees themselves. What were you going to do with your bees back there in Salt Lake City when you first started?
You know, I didn't really know what I was going to do with them. I just started with them, and, you know, it's hard to have one beehive.
Ah, here we go, right?
Well, the first week I had my first beehive, I went to Sears to get my Mary Tiller repaired. There was a swarm of bees on a guy's camper truck on the rear view mirrors. So I, someone in the Sears store had a gunny sack, you know, an old potato sack.
Mm-hmm.
Put them in there and put them in my Volkswagen bus and drove them down to my mom's house and put them in another box. And then I had two beehives.
Wow. So how did you collect them in a sack? I mean, didn't they sting you when you put them in a sack, in a gunny sack?
Well, you know,
like that?
I got stung, but when they swarm and they light somewhere, they're usually in a ball.
Mm-hmm.
And their whole purpose then is to start a new hive. So they're usually full of honey. And when bees are engorged with honey or sweets or sugar, they usually don't sting.
Huh.
You can get stung hiving a swarm, but, you know, not very often.
So you started with one hive, and within a very short period of time, you're up with two hives. And how many hives did you finally end up with there in Salt Lake?
Well, about a month later, I bought 100 hives from a lady in Gunnison who her and her husband had bees and honey for years, and they had been in her backyard for about 50 years. I bought 100 beehives for $10 a piece.
Then you're a professional, right?
Well, I was an amateur with 100 beehives, and they had been not managed, so they were real mean. I moved them up to a place north of Salt Lake City called Fruit Heights, Utah, and I put them there in the cherry orchards.
You said they weren't managed, so they were really mean. What does that mean?
Well, they had just kind of requeened themselves and had just been left to their own devices.
Ah.
So
they hadn't been handled, they weren't used to being handled, and therefore they weren't going to be handled.
Yeah, you know, and this is before African bees, or it's way before mites. It was maybe before tracheal mites.
Mm-hmm.
So when I put them up there, and I it took me a couple weekends to get them up there. The first load I took up there, I went home, and because I did it at night, and I went home, and that next morning the phone rang, and the neighbor called up and said, you know, your bees are chasing my ducks. You got to move them.
So the bees were actually chasing the ducks, which were probably snooping around the hives to see what was going on, right?
Well, actually, they were about 50 feet from the hive. Some of these bees were just pretty aggressive.
Pretty aggressive, huh? Interesting. And when you handle them a lot, do they get used to people, or is there some intelligence that goes through the colony of bees and say, hey, we're used to these people, they're okay?
Well, what's really good is that now with the internet, you can learn a lot about them. And
right.
This guy in the 1800s, Langstroth, he realized if you smoke them, then they'll eat honey. When they eat honey, they're more docile.
Is that what happens when you smoke them?
Yeah, they go right for the honey. So you smoke them, then you wait a few minutes so that they can load up, and then you maybe give them a little bit more smoke, and then you open them up and you can work with them.
Huh. So that's probably a survival reaction to forest fires or something like that.
Yeah, they say, well, the place is burning down. We better load up. So
we better load up for a long flight to somewhere, right?
Yeah. So
I never knew that. That's an interesting fact then.
Yeah, there was a guy named Huber, Swiss guy, in like 1800, that wrote and discovered just about everything about bees that has been known about bees, except for four or five things, and he was blind.
Wait a minute, except for four or five things?
I think they're just about everything. He discovered that the queen left the hive to mate. He discovered that the queen mated more than once. He figured all this out, and he was blind. And he taught his assistant how to observe, and he wrote this book in, I think, 1809.
I told you there's something about bee people that are just fascinating. So here's a blind man that learns everything there is to know, except for four or five things about bees, right?
Yeah, he knew one thing that was worse than being blind, and he knew the one thing that was worse than being blind was thinking you could see. So he just taught his assistant how to observe.
Wow. Okay, so you're there in Salt Lake City in Colorado with 100 hives of bees. How did that work out for you?
You know, it worked out pretty good. It's harder, a little bit trickier there than California because you get the winters, you know,
mm-hmm.
pretty long. So the collection of honey or the honey flow time, it happens really quick, like March, April, May, and June, and then maybe again in August or September, and then it's over. So you have to leave them more stores so that they can survive the winter.
Which is to say, leave them more of their own honey?
Yeah, their own honey and their own pollen.
Mm-hmm. And that helps them out then? They can survive extended periods of time with that?
Yeah, they just get in a cluster and they shuffle their wings, and that's how they generate heat, and that's how they stay warm.
Huh. Folks, you're tuned into The Food Chain. I'm Michael Olson, your host for this hour. Today we're having a little fun with Kirk Anderson of kirksurbanbees.com. We're talking about raising bees in, of all places, the big city, the big city bees. Kirk is down there in Los Angeles where he has a small bee company, and we're learning how to do bees in the big city. And we're asking the question, what do honeybees have to offer the big city? We will be right back. Please do stay tuned.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of Metro Farm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. Metro Farm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. Metro Farm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. Metro Farm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of Metro Farm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Bees are so sensitive, they seem to die en masse at the first sign of trouble. As such, they have become canaries in the mine of our environment. And given their great die-offs of the past few years, you must believe that our environment must be in deep trouble. But this leads us to ask, why are honeybees thriving in Los Angeles?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 591st edition of The Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Buenos Aires who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are, wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Nikki James, producers Carol Stafford, Parmley Taff, and Kelsey Olson. Folks, with colony collapse disorder being the order of the day, it has been hard times for the honeybees of our world. And yet they seem to be surviving and prospering in the most unnatural of locations, like the city of Los Angeles. And so today we pause to ask, what do honeybees have to offer the big city? Here to help us find an answer, we have Kirk Anderson of Kirk's Urban Bees in Los Angeles, California. Kirk, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thanks for having me.
Pleasure to have you aboard. Kirksurbanbees.com. What are you?
Well, I'm just a beekeeper, an urban beekeeper. I'm actually a house painter, but on the side, I like bees, so I play around with bees.
Well, we always ask the question, who pays the way? So if you're a house painter, we have a pretty good notion of who's paying your way, right?
Yeah, that's right. I'm paying my own way.
You're not getting a grant from some large government institution or some large corporation. This is Kirk Anderson of Kirk's Urban Bees, and he pays his own way, which is where we want to be, too. Let's start at the beginning, Kirk. You were born and raised in Salt Lake City. Is that where you first discovered bees?
Yep, that's where I first started. I ordered my first package of bees from Montgomery Ward through the mail.
Wow. And why did you do that? What led you to order bees, of all things?
Well, I was just sitting down having some tea with my friend Stu Gelb, who had just arrived in Salt Lake City from the Wheeler Ranch commune in California. He said, boy, the price of honey is way up. I said, well, we should get some beef. So I went and ordered some beef.
And Montgomery Ward, now there's an old name. That would be a name that would please my father to no end. Monkey Wards, he called him.
Yeah, Montgomery Wards and Sears both used to have a ranch catalog where you could order chickens, ducks, bees. Hmm. But then Montgomery Ward went out of business, and then Sears stopped their ranch catalog, and so...
And so no more bees in the Monkey Ward catalog, right?
That's right.
So you ordered bees. What happened?
Well, they came in the mail, and the postman...
How do bees come in the mail?
Well, they come in a screened cage with a can of food and a queen bee. And the mailman knocked on my door and said, you have to come out and get them. They're in a box in the mail truck. I don't want to touch them.
There they were.
So I had bought a beehive in the meantime and put it together, and I took them down to my mother's house and put them in the box, and that's how I started.
And said, here, Mom, have a beehive?
Yeah, my mother's house.
How did she react to that?
Oh, she didn't mind. She thought it was great. My dad thought I was crazy, but she thought it was great.
So you became a bee. How old were you then?
I was about 25 then.
Okay, so young man in the bee business. What were you aiming for then?
You know, I was just fascinated by bugs.
Mm-hmm.
I've always liked insects, and I always liked bugs, and I always liked gardens, and I liked living things, and the bees have a lot to do with it. You know, you spend the day with some bees, and once you get stung, you know, they've got you.
So to speak, and actually do, don't they?
Yeah, so...
I guess, you know, Kirk, they've got me because I guess about once a year I like to check in with the bees and the people of the bees, because I find the people of the bees, like you, almost as fascinating as the bees themselves. What were you going to do with your bees back there in Salt Lake City when you first started?
You know, I didn't really know what I was going to do with them. I just started with them, and, you know, it's hard to have one beehive.
Ah, here we go, right?
Well, the first week I had my first beehive, I went to Sears to get my Mary Tiller repaired. There was a swarm of bees on a guy's camper truck on the rearview mirrors. So I, someone in the Sears store had a gunny sack, you know, an old potato sack.
Mm-hmm.
Put them in there and put them in my Volkswagen bus and drove them down to my mom's house and put them in another box. And then I had two beehives.
Wow. So how did you collect them in a sack? I mean, didn't they sting you when you put them in a sack, in a gunny sack?
Well, you know,
like that?
I got stung, but when they swarm and they light somewhere, they're usually in a ball.
Mm-hmm.
And their whole purpose then is to start a new hive. So they're usually full of honey. And when bees are engorged with honey or sweets or sugar, they usually don't sting.
Huh.
You can get stung hiving a swarm, but, you know, not very often.
So you started with one hive, and within a very short period of time, you're up with two hives. And how many hives did you finally end up with there in Salt Lake?
Well, about a month later, I bought 100 hives from a lady in Gunnison who her and her husband had bees and honey for years, and they had been in her backyard for about 50 years. I bought 100 beehives for $10 a piece.
Then you're a professional, right?
Well, I was an amateur with 100 beehives, and they had been not managed, so they were real mean. I moved them up to a place north of Salt Lake City called Fruit Heights, Utah, and I put them there in the cherry orchards.
You said they weren't managed, so they were really mean. What does that mean?
Well, they had just kind of requeened themselves and had just been left to their own devices.
Ah.
So,
so they hadn't been handled, they weren't used to being handled, and therefore they weren't going to be handled.
Yeah, you know, and this is before African bees, or it's way before mites. It was maybe before tracheal mites.
Mm-hmm.
So when I put them up there, and I it took me a couple weekends to get them up there. The first load I took up there, I went home, and because I did it at night, and I went home, and that next morning the phone rang, and the neighbor called up and said, you know, your bees are chasing my ducks. You got to move them.
So the bees were actually chasing the ducks, which were probably snooping around the hives to see what was going on, right?
Well, actually, they were about 50 feet from the hive. Some of these bees were just pretty aggressive.
Pretty aggressive, huh? Interesting. And when you handle them a lot, do they get used to people, or is there some intelligence that goes through the colony of bees and say, hey, we're used to these people, they're okay?
Well, what's really good is that now with the internet, you can learn a lot about them. And
right.
This guy in the 1800s, Langstroth, he realized if you smoke them, then they'll eat honey. When they eat honey, they're more docile.
Is that what happens when you smoke them? They just
they go right for the honey. So so you smoke them, then you wait a few minutes so that they can load up, and then you maybe give them a little bit more smoke, and then you open them up and you can work with them.
Huh. So that's probably a survival reaction to forest fires or something like that.
Yeah, they say, well, the place is burning down. We better load up. So
we better load up for a long flight to somewhere, right?
Yeah. So
I never knew that. That's an interesting fact then.
Yeah, there was a guy named Huber, Swiss guy, in like 1800, that wrote and discovered just about everything about bees that has been known about bees, except for four or five things, and he was blind.
Wait a minute, except for four or five things?
I think just about everything. He discovered that the queen left the hive to mate. He discovered that the queen mated more than once. He figured all this out, and he was blind. And he taught his assistant how to observe, and he wrote this book in, I think, 1809.
There's something about bee people that are just fascinating. So here's a blind man that learns everything there is to know, except for four or five things about bees, right?
Yeah, he knew one thing that was worse than being blind, and he knew the one thing that was worse than being blind was thinking you could see. So he just taught his assistant how to observe.
Wow. Okay, so you're there in Salt Lake City in Colorado with 100 hives of bees. How did that work out for you?
You know, it worked out pretty good. It's harder, a little bit trickier there than California because you get the winters, you know, pretty long. So the collection of honey or the honey flow time, it happens really quick, like March, April, May, and June, and then maybe again in August or September, and then it's over. So you have to leave them more stores so that they can survive the winter.
Which is to say, leave them more of their own honey?
Yeah, their own honey and their own pollen.
Mm-hmm. And that helps them out then? They can survive extended periods of time with that?
Yeah, they just get in a cluster and they shuffle their wings, and that's how they generate heat, and that's how they stay warm.
Huh. Folks, you're tuned into The Food Chain. I'm Michael Olson, your host for this hour. Today we're having a little fun with Kirk Anderson of kirksurbanbees.com. We're talking about raising bees in, of all places, the big city, the big city bees. Kirk is down there in Los Angeles where he has a small bee company, and we're learning how to do bees in the big city. And we're asking the question, what do honeybees have to offer the big city? We will be right back. Please do stay tuned. Welcome back. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. Today, we're talking about urban bees, the bees of the big city, with Kirk Anderson, who is the proprietor of kirksurbanbees.com, a bee-keeping company and a bee-catching company in Los Angeles, California. When we left Kirk, you were telling a story about how in the summer in Los Angeles, when it gets really hot and there's not much pollen and the bees kind of go into the semi-dormancy, that the hives are often attacked by ants who overwhelm the hives and chase your bees away. What do you do to stop the ants? My wife, I'm sure, will want to know this one.
Well, I don't want to use poison and stuff, you know, because some of my bees are right in the middle of people's gardens. So I read some articles by Charles Martin Simon. He passed away about a year ago, but he was also a real pioneer in natural beekeeping. And he said he fed the ants. So what I do is I take some water bottles that I get from home, you know, the ones you get for a dollar and then you drink the water, and I put five or six of them around each hive, half full of sugar and half full of water, and then I put a ring of sugar around the hive so the ants go there instead of the hive.
Huh. Simple solution.
Yeah, it's non-poisonous, too.
So you have, take us to the urban environment now. In the initial parts of the program, we talked about how you got your start beekeeping in and around Salt Lake City, Gunnison, Colorado. Gunnison's quite rural, isn't it?
Yeah, pretty rural, yeah.
Yeah. And then how you move to the big city environments of Los Angeles, California. And this seems to be something that's going on around the world, where people are becoming fascinated with keeping bees in the big city. And of course, when you think about it, we grow a lot of plants in the big city, and there's a lot of flowers. So looking out of the radio studio right now, I can see flowers everywhere. So it's a happy place for bees, if they can survive the big city environment. Tell us about natural beekeeping in an unnatural environment like Los Angeles. How do the two come together? Or really, can you do it any other way?
Well, you know, I'm of the opinion if you put pesticide in the hive on strips, or you use acid or vapors and things, that it makes the bees weaker.
Ah.
And then they found out now that Apigard and all these poisons that they put in the hive to kill the mites have got resistant to them. So the mites become resistant to chemicals, and the bees get weak from the chemicals, and the wax gets contaminated with the chemicals. I don't know if I could sell any honey to anyone if I had a hive I treated. I'd have to say you're going to eat some honey from a hive that's been treated. Huh. So I found that what needs to happen...
Or if you were not very ethical, you wouldn't say anything at all and just let people eat the honey from...
Yeah, most bees are treated some way.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't treat them. I figure that they've been around a long time, and the strong ones will make it, and they have to learn how to live with the mites, because the mites aren't leaving the environment. They're here. They're not going anywhere.
So you followed the... Are you there?
Yeah.
Okay. You followed the direction of D and Ed Lusby, L-U-S-B-Y,
right.
And you went to a more natural system in which you rely on smaller bees in smaller cells.
Right.
And for some reason, they do not seem to be so weak as that they can't fight off the tracheal mites and the colony collapse disorder, whatever the heck that might be. Do you have any guesses or notions as to what colony collapse disorder might be as a beekeeper?
Well, I don't think it's one thing, you know.
Ah.
About 10 or 15 years ago, or maybe a little before, a little after, the importance on beekeeping went from honey to pollination. You know, you didn't see people 20 years ago.
Which, of course, is really the crucial difference now between rural beekeeping and city beekeeping.
Yeah, that's right. So, like, most people, like, I never move my hives, so that doesn't stress them.
Ah.
You know, I don't put them on a truck in Florida and drive them to California for the almonds.
And that's exactly what's going on right now. I mean, it seems like we're taking all the beehives in the entire United States and moving them to California for a few weeks of pollination, and then moving them all back to the rest of the United States.
Well, this, you know, say you moved them up to California for the almonds, then you went up to, you know, Oregon, Washington, mm-hmm. you know, apples, peaches, cherries and that, and then over to the Dakotas. You might move them two or three, maybe four times. Just say you're a beekeeper and you have to move all them hives. Do you really want to move a beehive that weighs 150 pounds? And you say you had 10,000 hives. I don't think you would.
Nope.
So I'm of the opinion some of them beehives are pretty light. You know what I mean? They don't have a lot of extra stores.
Ah, so they take everything out of there that the bees really need to survive then when they
move. Yeah, because I think sometimes even if you had bees in the almonds, you might even have to feed them. I don't know if there'd be enough in those almond blossoms to keep them going. I don't know. But I think the moving them, the stressing them like that.
So you're moving them, you're stressing them with moving, you're taking away a lot of their natural food because it weighs too much, you're drugging them with all kinds of pesticides, and you're driving them across the country, and then they just split.
Yeah, they just die. And then I think a lot of the produce that they're pollinating are treated with pesticides. And they're exposed to those too, because I've read on the internet in Germany and France and that now there's a certain nicotinoid-based pesticide now they want banned from that country because the beekeepers are losing their bees, and they say that's why.
Huh. So you don't move your hives; you leave them in one place. What place do you leave them though in the big city when you're in the big city? How do you find a place to keep hives in the big city?
Well, you know, the one thing about being an urban beekeeper that's different from being a rural beekeeper is you have to deal with people. You know? If you're in a city, cities are famous for having people. I've had people from the country say, how do you live down there, man, with all those people? You know, like L.A. County, how many million people's in there?
Yeah.
12 million people?
Yeah.
Well, I don't mind people. In fact, I like people almost as much as I like bees. So I say to people, you know, I'm an urban beekeeper and I'm doing this project. I have 100 beehives in the city. You know anyone that'd like to sponsor a location for a beehive or two?
What does sponsoring a location mean?
Well, all it is really, instead of saying, do you know of anyone that's got a place where they wouldn't mind having some beehives? If I say sponsor, that kind of includes them in the solution.
Kind of gives them an ownership, doesn't it?
Yeah, because, you know, a lot of people want to have a lot to do with nature and things, but they don't have a way of doing it. Some people might say, oh, yeah, we're green, man. We're green. We got a guy that's got two beehives in our garden.
Yeah. And not only that, but would you like to taste some of my honey?
Yeah, I give people honey. And, you know, and most people, they just love the idea that there's somebody actually doing something about it. I said, you know, it's not all bad news. There's some good news out there, too, about bees.
Wow. And how often do you tend these hives, then?
I usually go around and check them maybe once a week or once every 2 weeks, depending on what hive is doing what.
Mm-hmm.
Like I went to Memorial Day and picked up two swarms of bees out of one yard in Altadena where I've already got two swarms of bees in April. So when I'm through with the radio program today, I'm going to go add a few. They're a small swarm, so I'm going to take some frames of brood from one hive and shake the bees off and add it to the new swarm so they're have a little bit of more resources so that they can make it.
Wow. Folks, you tuned into the Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking about big city bees with a big city bee guy himself. That would be Kirk Anderson of kirksurbanbees.com. A beekeeping, a honey service. You're a little bit of everything when it comes to bees, aren't you, Kirk?
Yeah, people call me. I'll pick up swarms, and sometimes I cut them out of their house and take them away.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. Right back. Do stay tuned. What with colony collapse disorder, tracheal mites, it just seems like been a real tough time in the world. And yet, in the city of Los Angeles, bees seem to be surviving and prospering with the help of the big city bee guy himself, Kirk Anderson of kirksurbanbees.com. Kirk, before we went to the break, we were talking a little bit about how you collect swarms of bees. Now, when you started out, you used to buy your bees from the Monkey Ward catalog, but you don't buy bees anymore. You collect them in swarms. Why don't you buy them?
Well, for one thing, there's about $75 or $80 for a 3-pound package of bees.
There you go.
They've been treated. The queen's been kind of produced with a lot of other queens.
What does that mean?
Well, some people artificially inseminate the queens. So some queens, you know, one drone might, you know, fertilize a whole bunch of queens.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the whole success of Mother Nature is her diversity. So all these wild bees are about as diverse as you can get. Some of them are easier to work with than others. So I like the diversity of the wild bees.
I guess the logical question then is, what happens when you run into a swarm of Africanized bees?
Well, you know, it's hard to tell if they're Africanized unless you're an expert and you probably have a microscope. It's kind of been put nowadays that if they're mean, they are Africanized, or they must be Africanized. Now, in the 70s in Utah, I had bees that would staple my coveralls to my back, and this was way before African bees were even mentioned.
Wow.
So, you know, if, like 2 years ago, I had a hive that was so aggressive, when if I'd go to work them, even if I smoked them, there'd be so many bees in front of my veil I couldn't see. So I just split them up 3 times and found the queen, squished the queen, and ordered a new queen and put them in there, and then a couple life cycles, maybe 40 days, you have new bees, and they're calm again.
Amazing. And then when you collect swarms, you can increase your business without resorting to these weak industrial bees, correct?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, but, you know, even wild bees, you know, not all bees are created equal. You know, some of them take off. Some of them are incredibly productive. some are just so-so. Some of them just plod along. You know, they're like people.
Mm-hmm.
They're all different.
Which ones take off? Describe a hive that's likely to take off.
I caught two swarms in April, and I put them over in a place called Eagle Rock, California. Okay, and I put them in a one medium-sized box. And in 2 weeks, I added another box. And in 2 weeks, I added another box. They're in their fourth box now, these two hives. They're just gangbusters. I go there at 5 in the morning. They're out working.
Wow. Industrious.
Some of them, you know, they're like people. Some of them work harder than others, you know.
Well, when they're in the hive together, do they all exhibit that kind of behavior, or is it some are industrious and some are not?
Well, it's broken down by job. You know, they all have a job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that usually when you get stung or people get hurt by bees, a lot of times the bees that are the most aggressive are the field bees, the ones that go out to the field.
Mm-hmm.
But they're going out into the field and coming back. So if you run into any bees, it's usually a field bee.
Just on a personal note,
yeah.
If you were a bee, which bee would you be?
I'd probably be one of those workers.
I think I would, too.
But in about 5 weeks, you know, in a good year, when the honey flows on, 3, 4, or 5 weeks, their wings are wore out, their jaws are wore out, they're goners.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking I would like to be a drone, but the chances, I think, of a drone mating with a queen are like, what, 1 in a zillion or something like that?
Yeah, it doesn't happen very often. But no, they're very fascinating because drones kind of belong to the whole bee community. Any drone can go in any hive, and they usually don't hassle them. They let them in.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So, but they've already decided they're freeloaders, so they let them in and take care of them and feed them. But in the fall, when it starts getting cold and the honey flows off and there's nothing happening, they get rid of them. They throw them out.
Huh. I guess I'll stick with being a worker bee then.
Yeah.
Because the chances of me being a queen bee aren't very good anyway. So what does it take to become a urban beekeeper? For somebody who just would like to get tuned in more to nature, it has a lot of flowers. Is it possible to have just one hive?
I think so, but you know, like I've had a lot of people the last 30 years say they wanted to be a beekeeper, and I always give them the acid test.
Ah.
I always say, well, if you want to be, they said, I want to learn beekeeping. I said, okay, well, go buy a veil and some gloves and an outfit, and meet me here Saturday, and I'll start showing you. And I've had one guy show up in 30 years. That was a guy a month ago from Glendale Community College, and I helped him get his own hive started, and he's loving it.
Out of all of those years, is just one person?
One person.
What is it, the work?
I think, you know, it's a fascinating thing, but doing it's a whole other thing, you know? So, like...
Isn't it always, though?
Yeah, it is. I think it's just the passion. I think people that want to do something usually do it.
And those who don't.
I always knew I was on the right track in my life because I had so many people tell me I was crazy to be doing it.
Well, we're going to have to take a quick break, but when we come back, I'd like to give you a quick thumbnail on what it would take to be a good urban beekeeper. The steps, simple 1, 2, 3, where to start. And how to get in touch with those wonderful critters, the bees. Folks, this is The Food Chain. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating Rut Radio. We have urban bees, big city bees, which is something that is coming to the fore across the world. You see it just about every big city. Google urban beekeeping and, oh my goodness, a whole world pops up in front of your eyes. And we have Mr. Big City Bee himself, Kirk Anderson from Kirk's Urban Bees. How to become an urban beekeeper when we come back. Do stay tuned. Welcome back. A few more minutes and so much good stuff to talk about. We're talking, of course, about big city bees with the big city beekeeper himself, Kirk Anderson of kirksurbanbees.com. Kirk, when you started doing bees in Los Angeles, were there very many other people that were doing urban bees?
I didn't know of any, no.
So you were kind of like the Johnny Appleseed, if you will, of bees in the big city then.
My wife says I'm in the wrong century also.
Quite possibly true.
Yeah.
So hey, let me ask you before we go to how to become an urban beekeeper, what do bees have to offer the big city?
Well, they can offer it a lot of things. One thing they can do is they offer a lot of good free pollination, you know, to people so that their gardens flourish and prosper and do well. And that's the main thing they do. They're like the very important part of the food chain. Oranges, everything depends on those bees.
They say one-third of the food that we eat, one out of every three bites, is made possible by the good offices of bees. So what do we do to become an urban beekeeper? Step number one.
I think the first thing to do is, you know, get on the internet and go urban bees, find out all about it. There's three or four good websites, like the Organic Beekeepers on Yahoo. There's the Beemaster webpage. There's the Bee Source webpage. You can go on there and join them for nothing and say, I'm a newbie. I want to start being a beekeeper. What do I have to do? And you'll have 20 or 30 people answer your question on what to do, how to do it, when to do it, where to do it, how to get them to do it. The internet's like a big encyclopedia, but it's
like a big beehive, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a big beehive, but it's an alive encyclopedia.
Uh-huh.
You know, you can talk to it and it'll talk back to you.
Talks right back to you. Okay, so we get this information, then what do we do?
Then you just need to get your feet wet, I guess.
You have to make the commitment, right?
Yeah, so a lot of places have a bee club you can go to, and you can meet beekeepers and say, can I go along with you? Or could you help me get started? You know, bee people, they love agreement. They love people who are in agreement with them and want to do it. Most of them appear grumpy, but actually they'd love to just go all over it with people.
What about sponsoring a hive? What about finding a Kirk Anderson and sponsoring a hive?
Yeah, I think, you know, I don't know if anyone's ever done it before. I got the idea from the City Farmers webpage on Agricultural Notes here in Vancouver.
Mm-hmm.
They've got all these gardens up there. People say, I got a backyard that's open if anyone wants to garden. And you can find someone with a backyard and garden. So,
and if you can find a backyard and garden, why can't you find a backyard?
I said, hey, that's a perfect thing to do. So I just started talking to people about it, emailing people on my email list. I got four people waiting, so...
So you have four people waiting for hives?
Yeah, I've got five locations now, and I've got four locations to fill.
What do you do with all the honey?
I eat it, but I've decided to start selling it so I could kind of support what I'm doing. A lot of times I donated it to the Solano Canyon Community Garden in Chinatown, so as a fundraiser.
Uh-huh.
So there's another big garden over there underneath the... power lines over there's the 100-something acres, so I'm going to start hopefully teaching beekeeping and urban beekeeping and go from there.
Wow. And in doing so, you're really using these bees to bring life back into the inner city, where you would think there would be so much life, but in some cases it's not the kind of life that sustains life. You get those bees buzzing around, and it brings a wonderful sense of nature back to the inner city. This, folks, has been The Food Chain. We've had a lot of fun today talking with Kirk Anderson about big city bees. You can always visit Kirk at kirksurbanbees.com. Stay tuned next week for more What's Eating What Radio right here on The Food Chain. Remember, cheap food isn't. Thank you, Kirk.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.